get over there. Is it the best tool out there? Okay, hi, good morning everyone. How are we doing? Okay, so my name is Rabbi Ken Spiro. Just a little more introduction so you know who's speaking to you. I'm actually fourth generation Ocean Parkway, but I grew up in New Rochelle, New York. No one in New Rochelle here, I assume.
Yeah.
Where?
Payne Avenue.
Payne Avenue, by the statue of Thomas Paine, New Rochelle High School. I actually was raised totally secular. I'm reformed, non-observant. My kids were all born in Israel, raised religious. You know, Hebrew is their first language, which is really cool, by the way. My kids are probably the first people in my family to speak Hebrew as their first language in at least 2,000 years. But they don't know what secular is. They say, you know, Dad, what does it mean you were secular? What did you do Jewishly when you were growing up? And I tell them, on Passover, we used to eat ham and cheese on matzah. The scary part is I'm not making that up. And they laugh, and they go like, why would you bother with the matzah? I said, it's Passover, you can't have bread. So to say I was ignorant Jewishly would be the understatement of the year. Anyway, I went to Vassar undergrad. I majored in Russian language and literature and Japanese because I wanted to do international business years ago, before you guys were born. And when I graduated from college, I applied to NYU to go to grad school in business. I deferred for a year because A, I wanted to have a year off, and B, I wanted to get fluent in a language. We all know if you study a second language, you can study it for years, but if you want to speak it, what do you got to do? You got to go live there. Immersion. You want to learn Spanish, you got to live in Florida or Southern California. That kind of thing. No joke. There are seven states in America where Spanish is the first language. But anyway, I decided I'm going to go to Russia. That was my major language. Russia as a grad student. Now, this is a long time ago, before you guys were born, during the Soviet Union, before 1990. By the way, it was illegal for a Jew in Russia during the Soviet Union, talking about 1917 until, 1991, for a Jew to even study Hebrew. You couldn't study Hebrew. You couldn't learn Judaism. You couldn't own a Bible. You get thrown in jail for that stuff. So I ended up meeting a whole bunch of young Russian Jews, 19, 21-year-old guys, who were all secretly learning Hebrew. Secretly. No books. Just mouth, listening to someone teach them the words. Hebrew, and then the Bible, and Judaism, and they observed. The first Shabbat I ever went to, it was a secret Shabbat where the parents were hiding in the bedroom because it was illegal to have a Friday night dinner in your house. And the guys made kiddush, no kosher wine, no kosher meat. The guy made kiddush on a cup of water with some raisins floating in it. That was the closest they could get to wine. So we got it good. Anyway, I was so blown away. My plan was to go to Russia 6 months, and going to go to Israel. I was going to go to kibbutz. Kibbutz Ulpan, pick grapefruits with Danish girls, learn Hebrew, work on my tan, and go back to grad school. But after my time in Russia, I said, if these guys are risking their lives to be Jewish in this environment, there's got to be more to Judaism than I've been exposed to. Maybe I should do something a little more meaningful. I just pick grapefruits with Danish girls on kibbutz. I'm going to go to yeshiva. I'm going to learn about my heritage. So I checked into Eishet Torah. It's supposed to be 3 months. I stayed a little longer. I'm now at 11 months and 26 years. Whatever. I've been back a few times, don't worry. Anyway, I studied full time. I ended up becoming a rabbi. I got smicha, something I never planned in a million years. Then I got a master's degree in history from Vermont College of Norwich University. I'm also a licensed tour guide and author. And I spend about 80% of my year in Israel teaching and guiding and writing, and 20% I go on speaking tours to exotic places like Brooklyn. No. And that's why I married a travel agent. My wife is from London. She speaks English and tells me I don't. Oh, you guys from the States? All Americans. Okay. A couple Canadians, Torontonians, Montreal, Bathurst End. Okay. Guys, okay. I live in Kibbutz Zev. I have 5 kids. My oldest son is a great combination of jobs. He is a combat medic and a sniper in the paratroopers. And we know where he is right now. Anyway, should all be safe. Okay, guys, what we're going to do is 7 Wonders of Jewish History, which is one of my favorite classes of everything that I teach. Where it fits into our mashal, our analogy you just got from Reb Chaim, is this is outside verification. History is outside verification for the Bible. And I always like to begin this class with a story of a conversation that took place in the 17th century between Blaise Pascal. Any of you guys heard of Pascal? He's a famous French mathematician.
Right.
Enlightenment, right, exactly. There's some very famous mathematical equations that are associated with him. Louis XIV, the King of France, asks Pascal, show me proof of the supernatural. What does Pascal answer? He says, the Jewish people, Your Majesty. Like, what's so supernatural about us? We invented bagels? In Pascal's mind, the fact that we survived was supernatural. Imagine what he'd say to see us sitting here today. And guys, that's what we're going to see. Jewish history is supernatural. It's comprised of a series of trends or events. Each and every one of them is unusual, meaning only happened to a few nations or totally unique. Only happened to us. They combine together to make a history unlike anyone else's. No nation on the planet Earth has a history like ours. And we picked seven of them. There's a lot more than seven. I could easily do 25, but that would we'd be here all morning, and seven's more than enough to make the case. But the first thing we're going to see is that Jewish history just violates all the laws of human history. Violates all the laws of human history. That's a great class, by the way. But what makes this class really interesting, somewhat really amazing, I would say, and what makes it outside verification, is as unusually unique and therefore seemingly unpredictable as Jewish history should be, because it's so weird, it is all in fact predicted. Where is it predicted? Bible. Okay, at least you guys have read the book, I'm sure, at least once. At least your Torah portion for your bar mitzvah, that's the option, you know it well. You know it well, a lot better than the average discovery audience. So on one hand it's weird, on the other hand it's predicted, and we now living almost 3,400 years after the book was given can see that despite how weird and unusual it is, everything that's predicted either has happened or is in the process of happening. So it's the weirdness together with being predicted yet happening that makes it the seven wonders. Here's what we're going to do, guys. For each of the seven wonders, I'll write it on the board. We'll look in the book where it's predicted. We're not going to look at all the prophecies. That would take hours. You guys have seen these all already. They're all major prophetic themes. One or two examples from each. We'll read them in English. You can check our Hebrew translations if you like. We'll analyze, are these things unusual or unique? Do they fit together logically, and have they happened? And trust me, guys, a mere 45 minutes from now, you will have a much better appreciation of why Blaise Pascal says to Louis XIV, if you want to see supernatural, look at the Jewish people. Everyone with me? So far, so good? I always speak too fast. I'm not speaking too fast. I was teaching in Montgomery, Alabama. Anyone from the South here? No Southerners? Where are you from? Dallas. Oh, that's all. Yeah. Two Dallas guys on the other side of the room. Yeah, Texans. Okay, but anyway, you know, the South is a wonderful place, but everything is like half speed. The entire state sounds like Forrest Gump. It's unbelievable. I'm in Montgomery. Lovely people. Really polite. Nicest people. So, I'm teaching two, 3 years ago in Montgomery, and about 2 minutes into the class, a guy raised his hand and he says, would you mind slowing down a bit? So I love accents, so I said, okay. She didn't like. So he said, just because we talk slow doesn't mean we're stupid. I wanted to say stupid is a stupid does. What a question. Yeah.
Prophets in general are so, like, broad.
Prophets are so broad.
If you look in the Gemara, you'll see them being like, oh, this is the textual basis for this and this and this. Can't you... You're going to say that you're going to use prophecies in order to prove these things. They were predicted. But couldn't you... If they were interpreted another way, they could have predicted something that never happened.
Okay, so that's a good... What's your name?
Josh.
Josh is saying prophecy is very broad. You can read many interpretations into them. If it happens this way... It's a good question. I would say the best answer to the question is first, let's watch the class and see if we answer it. Because I think it's actually pretty specific. And I think the point is we made pretty well. But let's wait and see. Yeah.
Can I borrow your pen?
You borrow my pen. I charge per inch by the ink. No problem. Don't forget to get back to me. By the way, some people asked about recording this. Absolutely no problem. You're welcome to record it. But if you sell it, you got to give me 10% of the revenue. Now, for private use, there's no problem. Okay, guys. You need to share it with your friends. Okay, guys. First idea is the idea of eternal nation. That there'll always be a Jewish people. Eternal nation. There'll always be a Jewish people. If we go to page 52, gentlemen, turn to page 52. As quickly as we can. Guys, just one thing. There's a lot of you in here, so if everyone even mumbles a little bit, it's very hard to hear. So let's keep the background comments down to the minimum. Genesis, or as we know, Bereshit. A good rule of thumb, by the way, you should always never underestimate the absolute ignorance of the average Jew you speak to. They don't know the words Bereshit, Shemot, Vayikra, that kind of stuff. So if I lapse into these very like kind of Christian Bible sounding Genesis terms. You'll know it only comes from years of training myself, but I know you guys know what Genesis is, what Bereshit is. But look at quote number one. This is God speaking to Abraham, proto-Jew, the grandfather of all of us. What does he say? "And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout your generations, an eternal covenant to be the God and the God of your descendants after you." So God says to Abraham, between you and I, Abraham, is a permanent relationship. And since you're not going to live forever, that relationship will be carried on through your descendants. We're promised we will always survive no matter what we do. If you look at quote number two from Vayikra, "Thus, even while they're in the land of their enemies, I will not reject or obliterate them, lest I break my covenant with them by destroying them. For I am the Lord their God. I will remember them because of the covenant I made with their original ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, so that I might be their God." For better or for worse, there will always be a Jewish people. Guys, what's the best proof of this point? Who said it? Someone said it. What did you say? We're here. We're here. Trust me, very few Jews appreciate how amazing that is. If you are sitting in this room Jewish, almost 3,400 years after Mount Sinai, you're a living proof of the supernatural. By the way, most Jews don't even appreciate we're a nation. Most Jews think we're just a religion. Are you guys clear on this point? Even religious Jews are not so clear on this. Are you all clear that being Jewish is not like being Christian? Okay, Christianity is a purely religious identity. Christians don't have a common ancestry, a common land, or a language. We're a nation and a religion together. But we're not only a nation and a religion, one of the oldest nations on the planet Earth. Always reminds me of that joke. You know, there's very few ancient civilizations still around today. Babylonians and Assyrians and Mycenaeans and Philistines and Hyksos and you name it, they're all gone. Very few left. We're one of the only ones. But also in the Far East, there's some very ancient people, like the Chinese. So a Chinese guy is speaking to a Jewish guy one day, and he says, you know, Chinese civilization is very old. It's like 3,000 years old. And the Jewish guy says, yeah, but Jewish civilization, 4,000 years old. And the Chinese guy says, that's impossible. Where did you guys eat for the first 1,000 years? Well, now it's sushi, so we like it better. Anyway, we've been around a very long time. We may not appreciate it, but a lot of famous non-Jews have taken note of the fact that our survival is supernatural. Guys, turn back to page 50. Here's two famous non-Jews who have noted this. The first is quote number three, Mark Twain, whose real name is?
Samuel.
Very good. Samuel Clemens, author of like Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. Look what he says over 100 years ago. He says, go to the second paragraph. "The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and Roman followed and made a vast noise and they're gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch for a time, but it burned out and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?" Interesting. And by the way, it points out a very interesting point that I just mentioned. That we don't appreciate that almost all ancient civilizations are gone. They still exist, they're descendants, but as independent, Babylonians, Persians, those guys disappeared. Which, of course, is time for my commercial. I made a t-shirt that illustrates this point. It's actually one on the back of the room there. It's just for my history course. I have it at Eshet Torah on the website. You guys been to our website? I have an amazing Jewish content website, which, by the way, is a great thing to steer if you have secular friends or relatives and you want to like an easy way to get them into learning a little. Send them to the website. There's so much great stuff there. But on the back is one of the great lessons. It's really quite a supernatural point of Jewish history. This is the short list, by the way. You can't fit like 50 nations on a t-shirt. But it says, "Civilizations, nations, and empires that have tried to destroy the Jewish people and their status today. Ancient Egypt, gone. Philistines, gone. Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman, and Byzantine empires, gone, 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 gone. Crusaders, gone. Spanish Empire, gone. Nazi Germany, gone. Soviet Union, gone. Iran with three question marks." And then at the bottom it says, "The Jewish people, the smallest of nations, but with a friend in the highest of places, so be nice." What do you think? Come on. Okay. One for every member of the General Assembly. If you want one, speak to the secretary downstairs, you know, by all means. But seriously, by the way, someone just took the shirt. I saw a link yesterday. Some blogger took the graphic and changed the bottom, took Iran out, and put the Gaza or Hamas. It said Hamas, and it said in progress. God bless. God bless the IDF. Anyway, if you're interested, speak to Hannah downstairs. For you, special praise. The Middle East. By the way, who do you think buys this shirt more than everyone else in the world? A lot of Jews don't want them. I can't wear it. They'll kill me. I said, who's going to kill you? A Babylonian? They're already dead. the only people who might be upset, don't wear it in Tehran. You know, they definitely won't go over big there. But who do you think wears this shirt more than anyone else, by the way? It's an interesting side point. Evangelical Christians. They love it. God protects the Jewish people. Amen. Okay, look at quote number one. Guys, look at Tolstoy. You guys heard of Tolstoy, famous Russian writer? Yeah. Author of like great works like War and Peace? By the way, if you ever have like 2 or 3 free years of time to read, it's an excellent book. It's like 4 times the size of a Manhattan phone book. But look at quote number one, the bottom last paragraph, guys. What does Tolstoy say? The Jew is the emblem of eternity. He whom neither slaughter nor torture of thousands of years could destroy. He whom neither fire nor sword nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth. He was the first to produce the oracles of God. He who has been for so long the guardian of prophecy and to transmit it to the rest of the world. Such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as is eternity itself. So Pascal, Twain, Tolstoy, they're all saying the same thing. And as we go into the class, we'll see exactly why they say what they say. But let me ask you guys a question. So far, so good. It's what's predicted. We're sitting here in the room. But let me ask you guys a question. What is the number one point of identity? There's someone screaming siren. What's the number one point of identity for a nation? What is the thing that nations go to war for more than anything else in history? Combined, for sure. Land. Land, no question. Even most religious ideological wars are really just the justification for stealing people's land. So the strongest points of strongest points of national identity is land. So what would be a logical prediction, guys? Eternal nation, eternally on their national homeland. But what in fact is predicted is the exact opposite. Exile and dispersion. Well, let me ask you guys a question. Besides physically killing a nation off, what's the word for that? Genocide, right? What's the next best way to get rid of a nation you don't want around? This. Exile and disperse a nation. Scatter them around the world. What will happen logically within a couple generations? 100 years max, okay? Assimilate. Yeah.
Did God cause us to be exiled and spread out?
Obviously, yeah. But yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. Yeah, but no, hang on, you're right. Yeah, of course. Everything. It's a fundamental belief, and I don't say this to normal discovery audience, but you guys are the God squad, so I can say it. You know, you can't use the God word in discovery until the end of the seminar, usually. But obviously, we just believe that nothing happens by accident. But you're getting into a much higher, I know what you're asking. It's a much higher, like, philosophical question. We're just thinking logically. We're being skeptical. The average discovery guy doesn't believe in this stuff. He thinks it's a leap of faith. We're trying to look at evidence and approach this in a very logical, scientific, historical way. But exile and dispersion is totally diametrically opposed, let me get my red marking pen here, to the first idea. But not only that, remember I said at the beginning, guys, that everything in Jewish history is unusual or unique. Exile is not unique. It is unusual, as we'll see in a minute. There's very few nations who were exiled. But multiple exiles and dispersion, to survive one exile, to be come back again, to be exiled again, to come back again, is unique to the Jewish people alone. And let's see where it's predicted. Go to page 54. Top of the page. Leviticus 26, 33. And you I will scatter amongst the nations the point of my drawn sword, leaving your country desolate and your cities in ruins. Nice, cheerful prophecy. Go to Deuteronomy 4:26, quote number 3. I appoint heaven and earth as witness to you today to be cut off quickly from the land you are crossing the Jordan to acquire. You shall not remain there long, for you shall be wiped out. God shall then scatter you among the peoples, and you shall be left few in number amongst the nations where God will lead you. So we have exile and dispersion. So remember I said it's unusual. Very few nations in history actually exiled people they conquered. Almost everyone just lives on top of the people they conquer. In the ancient world, we know a couple of famous empires used to do this, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. But it's rare. In the ancient world, we know of less than 20 exiles of nations. The Assyrians were big on this. Pretty much no one else really liked to do this. In the modern world, it's almost unheard of. The only example I can think of pretty much in the modern world is the Soviet Union tried it with the Chechens in 1936. For 12 years. Didn't work too well. The Chechens are still attacking Russia to get paid them back. So it's very unusual. But of the few nations that have been exiled, we're the only one that's been exiled more than once, survived, come back, and been exiled again. And then come back again, as we'll see. Let's go through a little history. You guys know this stuff. This is review for you. Quick review of Jewish history in terms of exiles. After the death of King Solomon, what happens? We know Israel splits. 10 tribes in the north called Israel, Samaria, Shomron is their capital, and Judah in the south, with Jerusalem as its capital. Sorry? Sorry? You're being, okay, you're taking, I'm trying to be, you're right, I know, we always say 10, but it's complicated. Anyway, we'll keep it at 10 anyway, for the sake of simplicity. We have the Northern Kingdom, they both become vassal states, subjugated by first the Assyrian Empire. We know about 2,700 years ago, the Assyrians destroyed the Northern Kingdom, and exile those 10-8 tribes to, where do they go? It says, to Khalo or Khaba. These are places, by the way, in Iran and Afghanistan today. What are those tribes known as today?
Lost
tribes. Okay, where are they? Some people say they're in Passaic, New Jersey. There's no proof for that. There's an episode of, who's seen the original Star Trek? The Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk, like the original classic American television. All those guys are Jewish, by the way, in real life, which is why the Vulcan sign that Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock, uses, he got from watching the Kohanim bless him in synagogue as a little kid. There's an episode of Star Trek, the original one, where the 10 lost tribes come back from outer space and meet Mr. Spock. Now, I told you guys I wasn't into religion very much as a little kid, but I was very into science fiction. That was my first moment of Jewish reawakening, was Mr. Spock meets the lost tribes of Israel. And they still remembered Shema Yisrael. It was unbelievable. Oh, they said it in English. It was weird. Okay, but where are these guys? Where are these 10 lost tribes? All over the world, people claim to be... Of course, we know that some fled south before the destruction, before the destruction of the Northern Kingdom. Jeremiah's tradition brought some of them back. Mashiach brings all the lost Jews back. But there's a lot of people, millions, who claim to be descended from them. Guys, my personal favorite are the Afghanis, the Pashtunim. It's an unbelievable... They're talking about 15 to 20 million of these people. These are serious turban-wearing, Kalashnikov-carrying, RPG-shooting Taliban, who themselves claim all their clan names are descended, like the Rubaini and the Dani. They all have like these names from the tribes. And they have so many interesting little Jewish customs in their Islam. They're called the Jewish Muslims. I have a plan for these guys, by the way. I want to bring them all back to their Jewish roots, convert them all en masse, bring them on Aliyah, we'll send them into Gaza. It'll be quiet in 15 minutes, I can promise you. What do you think? 15 million Taliban of our own? It'd be incredible. Come on, no one mess with Israel. Okay. Anyway, where do they go? The reality is those tribes followed more or less the normal pattern, throw people out of their land, keep them there for centuries, they disappear. But let's keep going, guys. If we go ahead in history, we know about 2,500 years ago, the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. We go for 70 years to Babylon. We come back. We have a 420-year period of the second temple. First, the Greeks come, persecute us, Hanukkah. Then the Romans come. We rebel more against the Romans than any other people in the history of the Roman Empire. Destruction of the second temple in 70, Bar Kokhba, 132 to 135 CE. This time, we're driven out of our land because of the persecutions and the economic deprivation and all the restrictions. This time, we don't go to one place like Babylon. We scatter all throughout the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire. And we keep spreading and spreading and spreading and spreading until today, guys, we have this incredible phenomenon, the Jewish diaspora. What does the word diaspora mean?
It's not.
It means the Greek word for scattering. See, we think it's normal. There's so many things about history we take for granted that are not normal, that are unique. Guys, to be a nation that survives for 2,000 years without a national homeland is unique to the Jewish people alone. Until today, the two most ubiquitous, it's a great SAT word, ubiquitous, you mean you find them, you find it everywhere? The two most ubiquitous products on the planet Earth are Jews and Coca-Cola. There's some places that have Pepsi and Jews, but everyone's got Jews. I'm telling you, climbing up Mount Everest, 22,000 feet up, 6,000 feet short of the summit, there's a Chabad rabbi there. He's got cholin, he plays for Shabbos, you put the filling on today. We think it's normal, but it's not. Guys, it's a unique phenomenon, it contradicts the first, both are predicted and both have happened. But let me ask you guys a question. What is the first commandment that appears in the Bible? Not the Ten Commandments, not the Ruth. Very good. Fru. In Bereshit. The first commandment is be fruitful and multiply like the fish. Now you guys, of course, know this. I have to explain this to non-religious Jews. That's a mitzvah. It's a positive commandment to fulfill. Like keeping kosher, keep Shabbat. Don't forget to call your mother. These are all mitzvot. It's one of the big 10, by the way. Honor your parents. And Jews throughout history, up until recently, the vast majority of Jews have been religious and have kept the Torah and have taken that commandment very, very seriously. Which is why, even until today, the Jewish population, Jews in America, assimilated Jews, have the lowest birth rate of any ethnic group in the United States. To keep your population static, not growing, not shrinking, how many live births on average does every woman need to have?
2.1.
Some girl from a sem asked me last time I said that, what does point one look like? It's a statistic, not a reality. Otherwise,
I got point one of a kid, you know. We call him Pointy for short.
2.1. Jews in America, like 1.8. But what's the Haredi average?
17.5.
8 to 8.5. Rabbi Weinberg, Rosh Hashiva Beis Shem Tara, you should live and be well. He has 12 kids, Kanahara. And I remember like a couple of years ago, now he has like 120-something grandchildren. But because they're all married. But I remember like 4 years ago, one of his kids had like boys, had a double Brit. And it was 103 and 104. So I said to Mazel Tov, Rabbi Weinberg, you're no longer a family, you're a tribe. And now you don't travel, you get to migrate. But think about it, guys. Think about it. If you want to ensure the survival of a people, and you want to write a list of things they should follow, that is one of the smartest ideas in the world. Because we all appreciate that large numbers of people is a huge counterbalance to all kinds of other negative things, like wars, disease, plagues, famine, high infant mortality rates in the ancient world. And by the way, it even works against exile and dispersion. Why? Let me give you a control group. How many people in the world today, guys? A little over 6 billion. What's the largest ethnic, what's the largest nation in the world?
China.
India's going to catch up very soon, by the way, because India doesn't have the population controls that China has. But right now, how many Indians are in the world? How many Chinese people, excuse me?
1.3.
They're not going to keep growing, by the way. They're going to peak out very soon and crash because they have no girls. Anyway, it's a separate problem. But about one out of every 5.5 of you should be speaking Mandarin statistically. Don't panic. It's a lot of people. But that's an amazing thing, because imagine if we exile, let's put the Chinese into our control group. Imagine if we exiled all the Chinese from China. We leave 5,000 in Beijing, 3 restaurants, the rest have to go into the largest, 1 second, the largest diasporics. First of all, try getting a seat on China Airlines for the next 200 years, forget it. But they all have to go into diaspora. Where are these 1,300,000,000 Chinese going to go? To every major urban center on the planet Earth. Australia will become Chinese immediately. Manhattan will be Chinatown. What's the point, guys? Even exiled and dispersed, there will be so many Chinese that they will survive. So we should expect to put in, let's put in, there'll be so many Jews, since we have a commandment, we're an ancient nation, and we have a commandment to be fruitful and multiply, and we've always come out that commandment, there'll be so many Jews that even exiled and dispersed will survive. What in fact is predicted is the exact opposite, that will be few in number. And before I go further, you had a question. Had a question?
There are like a lot of, all these things are unique about Jewish people, but why do we necessarily have to point to God? I'm sure you can.
I'm not using the God word at all. I'm looking straight through logical history. I never bring in God in the seminar unless you guys keep bringing him up. You're too religious for me, but okay. Now seriously, I'm trying to be logical here. I'm staying away from that deliberately. But few in number, sorry?
I just say like, yeah. Isn't it maybe what's really unique is the unique combination of nationhood and religion that's so strong for both of them. Is there any other ancient nation that...
Yeah, by the way, we are today the remainder of what used to be everywhere. As a matter of fact, in all ancient nations had their own private religions, and usually the king was the high priest. The uniqueness of Jewish governmental system was separating those jobs, Kohen Gadol and Melech. But no, it's not a unique thing. And today it is kind of, today have state religions, like the British have the Anglican Church, you know, that kind of thing. There are countries that have religions that everyone, like Russia is all Eastern Orthodox. But definitely in the ancient world, like the Roman Empire, had Roman state religion. Absolutely. The gods are on our side, for sure. Zeus is our guy, you know. Jupiter, excuse me. Zeus was the Greek guy. They merged. Okay, it was ethnic blending. Okay. But guys, we would expect to see there'd be so many Jews. What in fact is written is this few in number. Now think about it. To be a small number of people scattered around the world, logically, don't use us as a precedent, but logically, is a recipe for what?
Disaster.
Assimilation. So this contradicts... This alone contradicts survival, but together with exile and dispersion, no way. By the way, few in number is a non-normal demographic pattern. I can't claim to know the demographics of every nation in human history. No one knows that. But I certainly know of nothing similar to the Jewish people. The general rule is, if you survive, you grow. Okay? That's how it works, as we'll see in a minute. But first, let's see where this is predicted. Go to page 62, guys, and we'll see these predictions. Two quotes from Dvarim, top of the page. The first is Deuteronomy 28 on the left side. You shall remain few in number, whereas you could have become as numerous as the stars of heaven, because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. So we could be numerous, but this prophecy is specifically linked to being in diaspora. No matter what you try and do, you will stay small, as it says on the other side of the page, 427 in Dvarim. You shall remain few in number amongst the nations where God shall lead you. Okay.
So we already talked about the exile and dispersion, but let's look at the demographic reality. Before we do that, let's use a control group so we see what normal demographics are. Look at the bottom of the page, guys. See the Chinese? We're back to our friends the Chinese again. By the way, this graph is not really proportionally accurate. What do I mean? 1000 BCE until 1880, which is almost 3,000 years, is the same amount of space horizontally on the graph as from 1880 to 1995, 115 years later. Which means that you don't really get a sense of how weird Jewish demographics are. Now, we haven't gotten to them yet, but this is what the Jewish demographics look like. This would be the first century of the Common Era 2,000 years ago. This would be the next 1,000 years plus. This would be, like, pre-Holocaust, and this would be post-Holocaust. But the point is, guys, we have this huge chunk of time in the middle of 1,000 years plus where the Jewish population not only doesn't change, it skims the line of extinction. But let's put that on hold for a minute. Look at our friends the Chinese. Ancient nation. One of the first countries to do a census, by the way. The Han Dynasty, 2,200 years ago, did a census. How many Chinese were there in China? 30 million. By the way, hey, that's like three blocks square of Beijing. But that's a lot of people for the ancient world. Remember we said there's 6 billion plus people in the world today. There's about 6,000 years of civilization, earliest cities. You might think it's logical. Every 1,000 years we added on a billion people. You think that's true? Uh-uh. When do you think historians estimate that the world hit 1 billion? Very good, very good. Basically mid-19th century. A little like late Enlightenment. 1850, 1880. It took about 5,500 years to get to 1 billion, and it took like 150 years or less to go from 1 to over 6 billion. It's unbelievable. You know, in the last 60 years, pretty much since the end of World War II, the world's population has gone up 70%. Okay? So the Chinese, if you go back to them, this graph is not meant to show you accurately all. Just showing you, they had wars, plagues, famine, high infant mortality, you name it, but their birth rate goes 30 million right up to 1 point over 3 billion today. Jews in the ancient world. We don't always have censuses. It's hard to know exactly, but every historian that I've looked at who's estimating Jewish population in the ancient world estimates that in the Roman Empire, there are between 5 to 7 million Jews in the Roman Empire. That's huge, by the way. The whole Roman Empire was only 50 million people. Jews were 10 to 20% of the Roman Empire, depending upon where you were. Plus another million Jews living in Persia. Between, that's a huge margin, 6 to 8 million Jews in the world. That's a big difference. Let's take the median number. Let's say 7 million. 7 million Jews 2,000 years ago. Everyone, by the way, getting married super young. Lest you think that is something old, like in the Bible, you know, all these the patriarchs getting married really. By the way, someone got married pretty old, like Isaac. Yeah. But Rabbi Weinberg, I mentioned Rosh Hashiva, he's the youngest son of his father's third wife. His father outlived two wives. He's the youngest son of the third wife. He told me that his father was first married like in the very late 19th century, like 1900, when it was Turkish Palestine. He lived here. He was 13 years old. He was married to a 12-and-a-half-year-old. This is my Rosh Hashiva's father, okay? This is not like Abraham in the Bible, guys. So think about it. Everyone getting married as young as possible, having as many babies as humanly possible. 7 million Jews in the world 2,000 years ago. Chinese, we go 2,200 years. We go from 30 million to 1.3 billion. How many Jews should be in the world today, guys? What do you think? Estimate.
100 million.
It has to be less than the Chinese for sure, because they had more people earlier than we did. Sorry? 100 million? The median number, not the highest, not the lowest, guys. 500 million is the median number. To 750 million to 250 million is the lowest number I've seen. But by the way, you know how many Jews are really in the world? But before you answer that, I travel a lot, I told you guys. I always like to engage non-Jews, especially on airplanes, in conversations if I can steer them into Judaism, just to get their perceptions of things. Do you know almost every non-Jew I've ever asked overestimates the number of Jews in the world by 10 to 100 times? A guy told me on a plane like 10 years ago, everyone in Hollywood is a Jew who changed his name and had a nose job. I said, you're a little anti-Semitic, but about 50% right. Ever since I found out that Scarlett Johansson is Jewish, you know anything is possible. She is. As is Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter. Harry Potter is Jewish. Let's hear it, guys. Okay. As is Joaquin Phoenix. Okay? So now you know. Okay, seriously.
No.
Guys, we'll play
We'll play who's Jewish later. But guys, hold on a second. How many Jews are really in the world today? Jews. I'm talking about halakhically. Okay, given that there's a range. I'm not people who eat bagels on Sunday, but like probably how many Jews are really halakhically Jewish in the world today? 12.5 to 13 million is the number used. Okay? Think about that, guys. Pre-Holocaust, there was about 17 to 18 million Jews in the world. We know how many died during the Holocaust. Well, let's take the lower number. Let's say there's 11 million post-Holocaust. Think about it. In the same 60 years that the world's population has gone up 70%, the Jewish population has barely changed at all. That's ridiculous. 12.5 million Jews in the world today when we were maybe 8 million, 7, 8 million in the world 2,000 years ago? That's ridiculous change in population. So, nothing. We're 0.25% of the world's population. Hold on one second. 0.25% of the world's population. You know the Chinese census in 1995? You know, you always miss a few people in a census. You don't get everyone. Not everyone's home. You know what the margin of error of the Chinese census in 1995 was? Ready for this, guys? Plus or minus 48 million people. Think of that, guys. There are four times more Chinese missing from their census than there are Jews on the planet Earth. 4.5 million Jews? Ridiculous. Wait, hold on a second. Get your hand up first. They're based on a lot of guesstimation of historical records within the land of Israel, people writing stuff like Josephus, and of course they always exaggerate, and Roman historians, and it's pieced together. It's a lot of guesswork. We can't do better than that, though, unfortunately. But it's not me making it up out of the clear blue. And you see it's a huge range, between 6 and 8 million people. It's a big jump. Question?
Are we counting similar Jews?
Obviously. We're counting from Jews. We're down to like a million. For sure.
Like, I'm sure that there are
lots of Jews. By the way, half the Jews in the world are not affiliated with anything, you should know. There are 800,000 Jews being raised in households with no religion or another religion. This is all the Chorban, the demographic suicide of the Jewish people, by the way. If we just stayed, it's a great point, by the way, you should be aware of. You know, if you heard that 100,000 Jews are being murdered somewhere, you'd be going nuts. You should realize what's going on in the world. It's exactly what's going on, although it's not physical death, it's spiritual death. If we just stayed equal to the world's population, let's say there were 11 million Jews in the world, how many Jews, and the world's population is down 70%, how many Jews should be in the world today? Just staying equal to the normal.
18-19.
Sorry?
18-19.
Yeah, 18-19 million Jews, which means what? Do you realize at least as many Jews have died since the Holocaust and Hitler killed in the Holocaust? What happened to all these guys? It's a real important point, guys. We've got to wake up and recognize, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeb, but it's not our topic now. But certainly, by the way, to really answer your question, is for everyone who is Jewish in this world today, there's at least 1,000 Gentiles with Jewish blood. So many. They're usually the biggest anti-Semites, by the way, but that's a separate class. The point is, guys, and you should know, but for most of Jewish history, for over 1,000 years in diaspora, from the 1st to the 15th century, for instance, or from the 5th to the 15th century, the entire world's Jewish population was 900,000 to 1.5 million. That's the entire world's Jewish population for 1,000 years. That many, 1.5 million Jews live within 30 miles of Manhattan today, skimming the line of extinction. That any of us are here today, guys, supernatural. But certainly, these two things combined together, no way. So let me ask you guys, what else can we throw into this to make sure that we don't survive? I said this to a regular discovery a few weeks ago, and a kid yells out, after school Hebrew school. I laughed for 5 minutes. I went through that, by the way. The Reform movement, I was raised Reform. They just spent like $3 million on a survey. I would have taken $5 and saved them all that time. You know what they found out? This is interesting and scary. That the intermarriage assimilation rate is higher for kids who go to after-school Hebrew than kids who have no Jewish connection at all. Why do you think, by the way? Sorry?
You understand having to do it.
Yeah. What's midweek Hebrew? Hopefully you guys didn't go through this. It's you have to suffer after school in Hebrew school, which doesn't count for anything. A bunch of burned-out loser teachers trying to subsidize their income by torturing little kids who want to be outside playing. It's horrible. It was the worst. I used to try and get expelled every single time from the school. Whatever. I mean, you had to go Sunday also. But it was horrible. Like twice a week for 3 hours. Oh my God. Okay. But guys, seriously, what can we throw in here? We'll throw in anti-Semitism. Now, guys, the term doesn't appear in the Bible, but the concept is very clearly there. We're not going to go to the why of anti-Semitism today. We have a wonderful, if not wonderful, it's not the best word to use, but a really powerful presentation we do that's called Why the Jews. Maybe you guys will come back or we'll come do it for you. It's a great thing to explain the why of anti-Semitism. I highly recommend, by the way, buying a book of the same title. It's not a book I wrote. It's a book written by someone who's very well known in America. His name is Dennis Prager, who lives in California, and Joseph Telushkin. Guys, go on Amazon, buy a copy of the book. It's so important to read this book and to lend it to a few people. We're not going to get to the why. It's a fascinating topic. What we want to do is look at anti-Semitism as it fits into Jewish history. Guys, we're going to see that anti-Semitism is unique. Like everything else in Jewish history, it's unique. It is the most intense, the most universal, the longest irrational hatred in human history. So look what's being predicted here. The nation that's going to outlast everyone, the eternal nation, is going to be exiled and dispersed, few in number, and hated by everyone, everywhere, longer and more intensely than anyone else yet survived. That's what we'd say in baseball is three strikes and you're out. At least you guys get the analogy, not English.
Cricket.
My Brit to cricket. What a great... That's, she used to drink beer for 3 days. My English wife is so funny. She, you know, only America has a thing called the World Series where no one else plays but America. I love it. Everyone else in the world, football is soccer. And America, my British wife, I want to get my wife a job. Like being one of these like sports commentators. She's sitting there going, I don't understand. This large black man is smashing into that large black man and neither has the ball. Think about it.
Good question.
Isn't the main damage of anti-Semitism towards Jews exile and dispersion?
What do you mean?
As in, the anti-Semitism is as an institution, its main effect against the Jews.
It affects them in the diaspora?
Oh, so you're saying exile as solely towards Israel, then it...
Anti-Semitism comes in all sizes and shapes and forms. Right now, guys, in case you're wondering what's going on in the world, there's a massive amount of anti-Semitism hiding as anti-Zionism, which is directed primarily towards Israel, but against Jews everywhere. It's not, no matter where we are, in Israel, not in Israel, but we're going to see it's a very unique phenomenon. So, let's see where it's predicted. First, go to page 58. A couple of quotes. Leviticus. Top of the page, quote number one. And those of you surviving the land of your enemies, I shall make so faint-hearted that if leaves rustle behind them, they will flee headlong as if from the sword, though no one pursues them, stumbling over one another as if to escape a weapon while no one is after them. So helpless will you be to take a stand against your foes, you shall perish amongst the nations, and the land of your enemies shall consume you. Very depressing prophecy, by the way. Jump down to quote number two, Deuteronomy. Go to the third paragraph. Among those nations shall find no respite, no rest for your foot. Their God will make you cowardly, destroying your outlook and making life hopeless. You will live in constant suspense day and night. You'll be terrified, never sure of your existence. In the morning you will say, if only it were evening. In the evening you will say, if only it were morning. Such will be the dread that your heart will see, that your heart will feel, and the sight that your eyes will see. Now guys, let me ask you, how many of us have experienced things that, like this description? Probably none of us, hopefully, thank God. You guys appreciate that what we're living through, my generation, your generation, we're the exception to the rule? We're just a couple of few generations in the last 2,000 years that has lived in peace and prosperity, not in ghettos, economically and physically marginalized, pogromed, murdered, expelled. This is the norm, guys. This is Egypt 3,500 years ago. This is the Crusades, the Khmelnytsky massacres, the expulsion from Spain, Jews in Eastern Europe. It's an incredibly intense hatred. And we see that anti-Semitism is unique, guys. In many, many ways. First, let's begin with a very important point that is really a little bit of a digression, but extremely important to touch on because of propaganda reasons. Just the definition of the word. And this you got to memorize. If you don't remember anything else from what I've said today, remember this at least one point. What's the definition of anti-Semitism?
Well, it's against the descendants of shame.
So. Against the... What's your name?
Zev.
Zev says, against the descendants of shame. Semites, right? Semitic people. Middle Eastern people are Semitic. If you hate an Arab, are you an anti-Semite?
Yes.
No. Okay, first of all, don't hyphenate the word. It changes the meaning. It's not how it was created. The word was invented by a German Jew hater. Remember this, guys. His name was Wilhelm Marr. He invented the word in 1879. The definition of the word in every proper dictionary in this world, Oxford English Dictionary, American Heritage Dictionary, Webster's, is prejudice or hostility towards Jews and Jews alone. The only place it appears as hatred of Arabs is Ahmed's PLO, We Hate Israel Dictionary. But seriously, guys, I'm 100% serious. It's very important. The Arab world's flipping this around. You Jews are the anti-Semite. You are from Poland. We are Middle Eastern. Semitic people. You hate us. You are anti-Semite. They say that. I say, first of all, A, we're Middle Eastern. Okay, might not look at all of us, but we are. That's a whole separate interesting discussion I want to get into right now. B, the definition of the word has nothing to do with Arabs. It's Jewish people. And C, by the way, even a Jew can be an anti-Semite. You guys appreciate that point?
Richard Hill.
Sorry?
Richard Hill.
Hey, Richard Falk, Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelstein. Come on. Sorry? What?
Woody Allen.
Woody Allen's definitely a confused human being at best and much more. By the way, guys, I don't want to get into proper Hasbara. I do a lot of campus work for colleges. But what is, just a good point to keep in mind before we go weiter. People often say, every time you accuse Israel of anything you call it anti-Semite, that's your Jews, the Jews' excuse. Whenever you criticize Israel, you say anti-Semite. What is the difference between legitimate criticism of Israel versus anti-Semitism, guys? What's the seriousness? Good thing to know for you guys to be aware of, because you're going to get this.
It's what,
exactly, first of all, depends on what's said, but specifically, when you single Israel out to the exclusion of everything else going on in the world, like the UN, which stands for Useless Nations Human Rights Commission, which has passed 26 resolutions in the last 2 years, 21 of them condemning Israel, 4 condemning Burma, and 1 condemning North Korea, then you know it's anti-Semitism. Or when you call for the destruction of the Jewish state. Genocide, destruction of a nation. But that's not our point. Let's not get into it. But we see, first of all, that anti-Semitism is unique. The definition, by the way, hold on 1 second. It is the only form of racial religious intolerance for about 130 years that has its own word to describe it. What do I mean? If you hate a black person, what are you?
Racist.
Oh, racist, right. If you hate an Asian, what are you?
Racist.
Only Jew hate has to have its own word to describe it. Question.
So you say that anti-Semitism is nothing to shame?
Nothing to shame at all. The word was invented by Wilhelm Marr, a German Jew hater, in 1879, and the dictionary definition is prejudice or hostility towards Jews and Jews alone. But the question you're really asking, what's your name?
Rafa?
Yeah. Was, why not just call it anti-Jewism? You know why? Because Marr, after Darwin, wanted to make hatred of Jews sound more racial and less religious, so he invents this word. But it means prejudice or hostility towards Jews. Yeah, question.
Isn't Marr's definition the first definition of genetic flaw in the Jewish people, which is why it's so...
Not a genetic flaw. He wasn't saying Jews are genetically flawed at all, by the way. Some of the biggest praise we get from in the world come from German anti-Semitic intellectuals. It's not that it's a flaw, but he said the Jew is the race. The race. So that means, and I don't get to that, it's way off topic. But he's saying it's not that Hitler tried to twist it one further and say they're inferior, but that's a separate thing. But Marr's point was that you have to define the Jews essentially as a racial thing, which makes them even more dangerous, because even if they assimilate, they still mix in with you and impact the world. We can't go there, guys. It's way outside the topic. I'll come to why the Jews, for you'll see exactly what we're talking about. It's very powerful, by the way. But anti-Semitism is different. Not only is it the only form of racial or religious intolerance, as its own word to describe it, there are a lot of aspects of anti-Semitism that set it apart. Go to page 57, guys. Top of the page. Big letter H. It says, history provides us with far too many examples of man's inhumanity to man, social injustice, religious oppression, cultural clashes, ideological wars, class hatred, and most every other form of racism and intolerance. One particular form ever stands out amongst all others, anti-Semitism. Unique in its universality, intensity, longevity, and irrationality, anti-Semitism is a historical phenomenon which falls outside of normal sociological bounds. Let me put that in simple English. The world is full of racists. Hold on a second. The world is full of racists and bigots, but Jew hate is different for four specific reasons. Its universality, intensity, longevity, and irrationality. Question.
So in this book, it's hyphenating anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I say, that's right. I buy it. That's because the guy who put the book together did that way. It's a mistake. It's not how the word was invented. There's a lot of people who do it. Even in the presentation, why the Jews, we have a PowerPoint.
Because if you do it with the hyphen, then it seems like it's against shame as opposed to...
I'm saying it's still, the definition is still in the dictionary. It's only one definition. It doesn't have the hyphenated version versus the regular. But I'm saying it confuses it, and the word was originally... Spell check, by the way, will put this in red if you don't hyphenate it. But the reality is the way the word was invented. Yeah, we got to finish, guys, by the way. I'm sorry I have to, like...
Am I just saying the definition?
Prejudice or hostility towards Jews. But don't trust me, go open any dictionary. Again, any normal accepted English dictionary, American or British English dictionary. You'll see it's right there. But guys, let's run through these four things that set anti-Semitism apart. Just so you understand that, like everything else in Jewish history, it's in a category all by itself. Yeah?
Where is the first paragraph?
That's a great question. You're like the third person ever asked that in 20 years. The reality is the first paragraph is from a guy by the name of Adam Sutton who wrote this book. I have a much better quote that I want to put in, which is from Dennis Prager. Where he says the exact same thing.
What do you think that a bigger issue is that instead of like having Jews advocate for Jews, we should try to target Gentiles to advocate for us?
It's a great question, but we just can't get into it now. You understand? And not disagreeing with that. We definitely have Gentiles advocating for us. But okay, but let's not get off to topic here. Let's look at these four things that set us apart, first of all. Universality doesn't mean everyone in the world is an anti-Semite, guys. There's a limit to Jewish paranoia. But unlike any other form of hatred, think about it. Take a Bosnian out of former Yugoslavia and stick him in Brooklyn. Does anyone care? No.
Stick a few hundred Jews anywhere in the world and anti-Semitism follows. It's a universal hatred. It's not linked to our relationship with any one people. That sets it apart. Number two is the intensity of anti-Semitism makes it unique. The dictionary definition might be prejudice or hostility towards Jews, but would that that were all it was? Can you imagine if the worst thing that ever happened to us was we couldn't get into a country club or a college? By the way, going back to, you know, 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, that was what used to be. Go watch this very old Hollywood movie called Gentleman's Agreement. There was all kinds of restricted neighborhoods and clubs. Remember Groucho Marx, the comedian from the Marx Brothers, once said, I wouldn't want to be the member of a country club that would have me as a member. Okay, but if that was the worst thing, no big deal. But the history of anti-Semitism is much more intense. It's history's most intense hatred. Look across the page, guys. Page 56, 13th century Europe. This is, by the way, this is not even 5% of the anti-Semitic incidents in 13th century Europe. But it's such an incredibly intense hatred. It's one unendingly, depressingly long list of persecution, physical and economic marginalization, ghettoization, punitive taxation, humiliation, rape, pillage, expulsion, pogroms, up to what is the worst thing you can do to people you hate, guys? Kill them. What do you call killing a nation?
Genocide.
Who invented the word genocide? I'll tell you who invented the word genocide. A Polish Jewish refugee in 1943 invented that word. His name is Dr. Raphael Lemkin. You can even look him up on Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge in this world after God. Shoot, I hope you guys, when you read it very critically, by the way. Sometimes it's very bad. But seriously, he invented that word in 1943. Fleeing from Poland to England, he writes, there's a crime happening in Europe there is no word to describe, and he invents this new word. Even that word had to be invented to describe the unique intensity of anti-Semitism. Number three that sets it apart, guys, is longevity. We've been around, like we saw in the first point, Eternal Nation. We've been around longer than almost everyone else, and for as long as we've been around, so too is anti-Semitism. It is history's oldest hatred. And last but not least is the irrationality. The reason why Jews are hated, and this is what our Why the Jews seminar is about. This is the point we're not going to be able to get to understand fully, but it's a very important point to understand. You know, if you ask a white supremacist to put on a whiteboard, he'd never use a blackboard. Why I hate black people. He'll give you 10, 12 stereotype horrible things black people supposedly do that make them so evil. If you ask a Jew hater to put on a whiteboard why he hates Jews, he'll fill up 5 whiteboards. I hate Jews because they're capitalist and communist, warlike and passive, different, the same, strong, weak, rich, poor, dominant, lazy. What's weird about our list? Besides the fact that it goes on forever.
Opposites.
Professor Michael Curtis at Rutgers University said it over 20 years ago. It's still the best way I've ever heard it said. Anything and everything is a reason to hate the Jew. Whatever you hate, the Jew is that. Whatever you hate. It's unbelievable, but guys, you put it all together, and we can't say more on this because it's a huge topic. You put it all together, you get a totally unique hatred. Combine it with exile and dispersion and fewer number, 3 strikes and you're out. There's no way we should be sitting here today, yet all are predicted, they don't fit together, they've all happened, and we're still here. So guys, let me ask you, what would you expect to see from a nation that's gone through this history?
Nothing.
They shouldn't be there. But not only is the author going to have us beat all the odds and have us survive, we're going to be a light to nations. Now this, by the way, is the topic that I would say if there's anything I'm an expert on. You guys know the definition of an expert? Someone knows more and more about less and less till eventually knows everything about nothing? No, I'm just joking. If there's anything I speak on, it's this topic. I even wrote a book on it. It's called World Perfect. I even have a copy right here. Oh, by chance. No accidents, right? Excellent book, Ask My Mother. She'll tell you it's the best book ever, right? You know, all Jewish mothers are an objective source of information about their children. You know the joke, Hattie, that Jesus was Jewish? He lived at home until he was 30. He went into his father's business, and his mother thought he was God. Okay. Him thinking his mother was a virgin is a different problem. But anyway, seriously, guys, it's a fascinating topic. It's a whole... No joke. It's a whole presentation of itself. But guys, in the context of this class, it makes no sense at all. What does this light to nations thing mean? So let's go to page 63. Page 63. And we will see the predictions. Back to Abraham, the proto-Jew, God speaking to us. In quote number 1. I will make you into a great nation, I will bless you and make your name great. You shall become a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Through you, all the communities of the earth shall be blessed. So God says to Abraham, the whole world is going to be impacted by you. But what does that mean specifically? Guys, turn over to page 64. Quote number 5. Isaiah, writing 2,500 years ago. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness, and I'll hold your hand and keep you, and I'll establish you as a covenant of the people for a light unto the nations. This is where the word first appears, light to nations. But Isaiah then goes on to explain what that means. For behold, quote number 6, behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and a thick darkness the nations. But God will shine upon you. Nations shall then go by your light, and kings by your radiant illumination. Isn't that beautiful? Nations and kings are going to follow us. Wait, time out. Are we in the same universe here, guys? Think about it, psychologically. You want to be like people you like or people you dislike? People you like. Little Jewish kids don't say, Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be like Adolf Hitler, Ayatollah Khomeini, and Saddam Hussein. What's the image of the Jew in the collective consciousness of the non-Jew throughout history? Positive or negative?
Negative.
Negative to an extreme, you have no idea. We are, in medieval Europe, the Jew is a subhuman devil. No one like, who would want to be like us? The most accursed people in the world. Okay, but guys, you got to appreciate that many nations who have not been popular have still had a big impact. I'll give you a couple good examples. Greece and Rome. How did they do it? What's the most famous military dispatch in all of human history, by the way? Begins. It's Julius Caesar's over 2,000 years ago from Gaul. Weni, witty, wiki. I came, I saw, I conquered. Remember the motto of the Roman army? Travel to exotic places, meet interesting people, and kill them? Seriously. They conquered the world with their empires, and they stuck their ideas and their values and their culture by force down everyone's throat. But that's the Greeks and the Romans. It's not us, guys. We're exiled as first few in number. Everyone hates us. Jewish empire? The only Jewish empire in history has been Hollywood. And it hasn't been a source. By the way, Jews invented the entertainment industry. Hollywood is a Jewish invention more than anything else in history, believe it or not. That nuclear energy. But seriously, and it hasn't been a source of Jewish values, Hollywood. But guys, given that everyone hates us, and we have no empire, no ability to force anyone to accept anything we think about, how in the world are we going to have an impact on anyone? We shouldn't even be here. Yet, guys, we have arguably had the biggest impact, greater than the Greeks and the Romans. And besides obvious Jewish contributions to civilization, like gilt bagels, junk bonds, leverage buyouts, Einstein, Marx, Freud, 22% of all the Nobel Prizes since 1900, 25% of the Fortune 500 list, what is the most important idea we gave the world? One God, and you said it together. One God and one absolute standard of morality. Call it ethical monotheism, call it whatever you like, but guys, it's for sure in the realm of spirituality, morality, it's the most impactful idea in history. It's probably the most impactful idea in all of human history. It's an idea which thousands of years ago no one even could understand. That Abraham was able to think outside the box and come up with that idea is unbelievable. But it's an idea which today we see has totally changed the world. Completely. We don't begin to appreciate how much one God and one standard of morality has shaped the world today, especially the Western world. Through Christianity, through Islam, through so many different ways. I can't go into it now because we don't have time. And I do want to show you at least one person of the many, many that I came across who appreciates how much the Jews have been a civilizing influence on the world. Jump back to page 50 for 1 second, guys. Go up to quote number 2, John Adams, second president of the United States. What does John Adams say about the Jews? Quote number 2. In spite of Bolingbroke and Voltaire, two famous intellectual anti-Semites, I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. If I were an atheist of another sect who believed or pretended to believe that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality and consequently of all civilization. Jump down to the underlined part. They are the most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth. The Romans and their empire are but a bubble in comparison to the Jews. They have given religion to 3/4 of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern. And if he were running for president today, I would definitely vote for him. Guys, in the course of writing my book, I came across dozens of presidents, prime ministers, philosophers, historians, thinkers. They all say the same thing. The Jewish people, we civilize the world. And we can't say more on that because we're running out of time here, but trust me, it is so contradictory to the thing we saw previous. Number 6 is on a different course altogether, but it's a very weird idea. It's the interdependency of JP is the Jewish people and LI is the land of Israel. That there's this unique connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. But first, guys, to appreciate this point, I have to understand a little geography. And I know Americans are not great with geography. Ambrose Bierce, who was an American writer during the Civil War, he wrote, it's a great quote, he wrote, "War is God's way of teaching Americans geography." It's amazing how well it works. I have students who can't find Mexico City on the map, but they can name every city on the Euphrates River in Iraq. Okay, but guys, a little geography. The land of Israel, you can imagine where it sits, in the eastern Mediterranean, is a very strategically important piece of real estate. It sits on many major trade routes of the ancient Near East. It also sits on the only land bridge that connects Asia to Africa. What's a land bridge? It's a piece of land that connects two parts of the world. If you want to walk from Russia to Tunisia, you got to walk to the land of Israel, which, by the way, is a big blessing for us and a curse for us. Why is it a blessing for us? For trade, for sure, it's great. But just to impact the world, we're in the middle of everything. From the very beginning of human civilization, we're smack in the middle of the ancient world. Imagine if Abraham had lived in Walla Walla, Washington. Would it take another 3,500 years for anyone to find the guy? What's the curse part of it?
War.
Yeah, everyone and his mother marches through the land of Israel. Whoever named Jerusalem City of Peace has like the worst sense of humor in history. You know there have been 118 conflicts surrounding Jerusalem in the last 3.5 millennia? It's unbelievable. The most fought over piece of real estate on the planet Earth. But it's strategically very valuable. But not only that, the Bible describes, guys, if you go to page 65, the Bible describes how the land of Israel is a very beautiful, lush, valuable piece of real estate. In Exodus, in quote number one, it's Eretz Zavat Chalav V'Davash, a land flung with milk and honey. You guys know Josephus, right? The great first century Jewish historian. Look at Josephus, and he's, by the way, he's known to be very accurate in terms of his physical descriptions of places. Look at what Josephus, in page 65, where it says the fertility of the land, the F in the box. Look at Josephus' description of the land. For the whole area is excellent for crops and pasturing, and rich in trees of every kind, so that by its fertility it invites even those least inclined to work in the land. In fact, every inch of it has been cultivated by the inhabitants, and not a parcel goes to waste. Guys, the land of Israel was the most extensively cultivated piece of real estate in the Mediterranean 2,000 years ago. Full of trees, an unbelievable, beautiful, lush place. Trees. There was lions and bears here until 500 years ago, until the Turks hunted them into extinction. Got a question?
What happened?
What happened is a combination of destruction and overgrazing and all kinds of interesting things that combined together, seemingly natural, but leading to this very interesting point that we're going to get to right now. So on one hand, we're describing a piece of real estate that's strategically really valuable. The other hand, we're describing a piece of real estate that is economically really valuable. Put it together, guys. You have one nice piece of land. So what are you, as Pharaoh, Alexander the Great, Caesar, going to do when you're marching around the Middle East with your armies building your empire? You're going to come to the land of Israel, conquer it, and do what to the indigenous population? We're the natives. What's going to happen to us? Well, that's not so likely. But we're going to be, for sure, subjugated, killed, enslaved, dominated. But what should happen to us? Guys, we should have been one of the first nations in the ancient world to disappear. So many people have lived on top of us. Bye-bye Jews. Hello Philistines. And hello Greeks and Romans and Assyrians and Babylonians and Mycenaeans and you name it. And Romans and Greeks and Byzantines and Muslims and this and Ottomans, Seljuks, Mamluks. Guys, we should disappear way before anyone. But the author is not only going to have us survive despite all the odds. He tells us, you guys are a unique nation. You have to be around. You guys have a unique mission, light unto nations, which you have to accomplish. Otherwise, the whole world's in big trouble. But not only that, you guys are a unique appliance. I found this out the hard way. I traveled around the world doing PowerPoint presentations. I found out the hard way that every country in the world has a different wall outlet. You know, the one in England is not the same one as in South Africa, as in America, as in Canada, as in France. I have like an adapter of the world collection that I take with me when I go anywhere. Guys, we're a unique appliance. The only place we could plug in and fulfill our destiny is the land of Israel. Which means the author of the book says, you're going to survive, you're going to change the world, but the only place you could ultimately accomplish your mission is the land of Israel, but I have to ensure the land is available to you. Therefore, he says, the land, interdependency, the land will react differently to you than to anyone else. When you live on it, it'll be great. When anyone else lives on it, it's going to stink. Anyone ever heard of such a thing? Land reacts differently to different people. Land doesn't know who's living on it. It has no consciousness. Sorry?
Gush Katif.
Gush Katif, exactly. Look at Gaza now without the Jews being there. It's a perfect example. Guys, turn over to page 66. You'll see exactly where it's predicted. 1a. So devastated will I leave the land that your enemies who lived over be astonished. Your land will remain desolate and your cities in ruins. Jump down to quote number 4, Yeheskel. And I shall make the land a desolate waste with its crowds of the seas. The mountains of Israel shall be desolate. No one will cross them. Then there shall be cry of God when I make the land a desolate waste because of all the abominable things they've done. And guys, if we make one more graph for the day, let's do a graph of Jewish population of the land of Israel versus how green the land is. And you'll see there's an incredible correlation between these two ideas. So from the 1st to the 5th century, the Common Era, guys, the Jewish population of the land of Israel declines dramatically due to all the persecutions, destruction of the Second Temple, Bar Kokhba, and all the Byzantine horrible persecution of the Jews, taxing them and banning them from Jerusalem.
So the Jews, by the time they get to the 5th century, 99% of the Jews in the world, my marker isn't working too well here, 99% of the Jews in the world are living in diaspora. There's always a teeny Jewish population here, but the whole Jewish world more or less moves into diaspora. If we do a overlay that with a graph of how green and productive the land is, it looks like this. There's a slight lag time, and boom. I just saw a fascinating article, by the way. Based on measuring the mineral deposits in stalactite caves like Nahal Sorek in Israel, you know, they found it amazing, it's so cool, that between the 1st and the 5th century, the amount of rain that landed in Israel went down by 50%. Unbelievable. From 1,000 millimeters of rain in the beginning of the 1st century to what it is today, by the way, still 500 millimeters of rain. Much less. Way, way, way down. Okay. But so the whole land turns into this desert wasteland. Hold on one second. You got it? Something quick?
Yeah, when they exiled, did anyone else live there at the time?
Yeah, of course. The Byzantines moved in. Well, we're going to see. Precisely because what happened to the land, very few people lived here. The biggest population is the Byzantine period, which is right on our backs. And as the land turns into a desert wasteland, the population dwindles and dwindles and dwindles until, look what it looks like. Great question. Look when Mark Twain came here 130 years ago, guys. Top of page 67. He wrote the book Innocents Abroad. Look at his description of what it looked like over here. We traverse some miles of desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given wholly to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse. A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reached Tabor safely. We never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky, bare, repulsive, and dreary the landscape became. There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and cactus, those fast friends of the worthless soil, almost deserted the country. No landscape existed as more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, and lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Very biblical language from Mark Twain, who was an agnostic. But do you see he's hit the nail right on the head, guys? Like, we're the kids, mommy's the land. When we're home, she's happy. When we're gone, she's sitting in mourning. She's barren. That's weird. Does everyone see it's a huge blessing in disguise? What do I mean? Let's take North America. Go back 400 years. Who lived in North America 400 years ago? No white people. Who was there?
Indians.
Well, you guys call them Indians? No, we call them Native Americans today. Whatever. The indigenous Native American, Indian population, whatever. How many of them lived in all of North America, by the way? U.S. and Canada. The entire population. Again, it's a guesstimate, but it's
million.
Between 750,000 and 1.5 million. Manhattan has several times higher population today than the entire continent of North America 400 years ago. These guys, by the way, were not environmentally sensitive people. They were not at all, but they were so few of them, and they were stone-aged. No writing, right? No metal. There's a limit how much damage they could do to the environment. So that was like green, beautiful, big prairies and forests. In comes the white people, kills off most of the indigenous population, cuts down the trees, builds cities, pollutes, kills the buffalo, builds railroads. Does America turn into a desert wasteland because the indigenous native population is obliterated largely by foreign white invaders? My British wife says, culturally, absolutely. She says, my wife says, American culture is an oxymoron. You know, like two words that don't go together. Like French military victories. She says, American history and culture. I say, British cooking. That doesn't give me dinner for like a week. Okay. Military intelligence also is one of those. Okay, but guys, why do I say it's a huge blessing in disguise? Jump ahead to 2009. What chance do the indigenous Native American population have of throwing the white people out of all or part of North America and recreating a Native American civilization independent from the United States or Canada?
Zero.
I have better chance of being president. What chance would we, the Jewish people, have of surviving the weirdest history in all of human history, where all the odds are stacked against us, outlasting the greatest empires, and coming back and reestablishing a state? According to all normal laws of history, never should have happened. But that brings us to the final point, which is the happy ending to our story, the cool idea, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. I specifically love this one because A, it's positive, and B, you can see happening before your eyes. Every day at Ben Gurion Airport. But guys, it's unique, but it's predicted all over the place that the Jewish people return to the land of Israel. Let's see where it's predicted. Go to page 68. You can see Deuteronomy, quote number 1, top of the page. And the Lord your God shall return you from captivity and have compassion upon you. You shall return and gather you from all the nations. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land your fathers inherited. You will acquire and he will make you even more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. Guys, jump down to the bottom. Jeremiah, quote number 4. For thus says God, shout with joy for Jacob, exalt at the heads of nations, proclaim your praise and say, O God, deliver your people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them back from the northern lands and gather them from the ends of the world.
And guys, this is exactly what you see. We've seen this amazing return of the Jewish people. We saw it in the 1990s when a million Jews from the former Soviet Union, who are the most ignorant, non-Zionist, disconnected Jews in the world, are like sucked out of Russia into Israel, like a tractor beam pulling them in. Guys, remember what percentage of Jews lived in Israel just 100 years ago? I'm not talking about, you know, 1,000 years ago. 100 years ago, your great-grandparents' lifetime. What percentage of Jews lived in the world? I'll tell you what it was. A half of 1%. 99.5% of the Jews in the world were living in diaspora. Okay? What percentage of Jews live in the world today? What percentage of Jews live in Israel today? Excuse me. About 45%. That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. It's literally like a rocket ship taking off. Remember we mentioned how the world's population, my mark is not working anymore, the world's population has gone up 70% in the last 60 years. The Jewish population has been flat out static. You know what's happened to the Jewish population of Israel in that same 60 years? You ready for this one, guys? 980% it's gone up in 60 years, making it the largest exponential growth of any country's population of the world in modern history. And granted, it's somewhat augmented by a high Haredi birth rate, but what overwhelmingly is responsible for the explosion of the Jewish population in the land of Israel? The diaspora shutting down and Jews returning. The last place is America. Buy property now, guys, I'm telling you. The Shia's coming soon. You're going to be competing with 5.2 million Jews trying to buy in the German colony. There are more Jews living in the land of Israel today than at any time since the First Temple period. Most demographers say that Israel now has the largest Jewish population in the world. That's incredible. And given current demographic trends of assimilation in America and Jewish population growth in Israel, within 15 years max, for the first time since the First Temple, the majority of Jews, please God, will be back in the land of Israel. Unbelievable. But guys, think about it. The land is barren when we're gone. What happens when we return?
Beautiful.
It blooms, boom, right to the ceiling, as it says beautifully. Look at quote number 7 in Ezekiel. As for you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people Israel, for the return is close at hand. And behold, I am with you, and I shall turn to you. Then you shall be tilled and sown, and I'll multiply men upon you, the entire family of Israel. Guys, you don't appreciate this. I'm not even old enough to appreciate this. But if you could have been here 60 years ago, think about this. We take everything in our history as normal but supernatural. Guys, what year did the Holocaust end? What year did World War II end? 1945. When was Israel founded as a state? 48. Think about it. 3 years after 70% of the Jews in Europe were killed in what is the largest slaughter, extermination of any people in human history, the remnant make their way over to this little sliver of real estate in the eastern Mediterranean, surrounded by hundreds of millions of hostile Arabs trying to kill us, okay, in a constant state of warfare and economic blockade, with no natural resources, having to absorb millions of immigrants, with a crazy Polish socialist trying to run the economy. You guys know the joke, how do you make a small fortune in Israel? Come with a large one. Yet despite all of that, we prosper. You know, Golda Meir once said, she had a great sense of humor. She once said, you know, I'm really angry at God. He makes us wander in the desert for 40 years and brings us to the only place in the Middle East with no oil. Forget, there is oil here. If you don't need oil, you want to hear a great statistic? Take oil out of the economic equation of the Middle East. And do you know that 5.4 million Jews far outproducing their gross domestic product, 300 million Arabs sitting in the 22 Arab states that surround us? They're a one commodity economy, the entire Middle East besides us. It's oil, nothing else. By the way, Portugal even does that. Even Greece has a higher gross domestic product than the entire Islamic world. Unbelievable. We don't need it, guys, but we don't appreciate how supernatural it is. That the desert, within a few years, is blooming and exporting fruits and vegetables to the rest of the world. That Holland, which is the largest flower exporting nation of the world, imports flowers from Israel to export to other countries. That there are more publicly traded companies outside of Canada on the U.S. Stock Exchange. There are more publicly traded Israeli companies on the U.S. Stock Exchange than any country in the world. There's more high-tech startup here than any place in the world outside Silicon Valley. That the International Monetary Fund in 1997 took Israel off a list of developing nations and listed as a fully developed first world nation with the 19th highest standard of living in the world, equal to that of Great Britain's, done in less than 4 years. In a constant state of warfare, terrorism, economic blockade. Guys, it's unbelievable. We don't appreciate it. You know the Ministry of Tourism used to have a wonderful motto. I wish they kept it. They called it, you know what the motto for the Ministry of Tourism was? Israel, the miracle on the Mediterranean. Israel, the miracle in the Mediterranean. It's all miraculous, but we don't appreciate it. So just to end with one final thing to focus on, to keep in mind for the rest of the day. Now, you guys are all sitting in this room. You have no idea how amazing that is. But jump back in time, 200 years, to your great-great-great-grandparents sitting in the shtetl in Poland, in the Pale of Jewish Settlement. 386,000 square miles of Tsarist Russian poverty and persecution. Imagine what they would say to see you guys sitting here today. Unbelievable. In a 100 yards from the Western Wall, something they would have given their lives just to touch once before they died, But not just here as students studying for the year, but in a Jewish country with a Jewish government, with a Jewish army. We've got a lot of problems, guys, but we do not appreciate how supernatural it all is. You know who summed up this class better than anyone else, in my opinion? Wasn't a big rabbi. Someone very against even that. David Ben-Gurion, David Green from Plunsk, Poland, first prime minister of Israel, who was religious and went the other way, anti-religious even. But Ben-Gurion appreciated the supernatural nature of Jewish history. You know what Ben-Gurion said? It's a fantastic quote. A Jew who doesn't believe in miracles is not a realist. A Jew who doesn't believe in miracles is not a realist? How could you say it? If you look at Jewish history, you see. Nothing realistic about our history, guys. It's a series of trends or events. Each and every one of them is unusual, unique. And again, we didn't even get to a third of the list I could have done with you guys. It combines together to make a history unlike anyone else's. No nation in the world has a history like this. No Las Vegas bookie would give you a million to one odds of this happening, guys. Yet we now living 3,000, almost 400 years after the book was written, can see that everything was predicted, no matter how weird and illogical it sounds, either has come true or is in the process of coming true. Guys, it shows me two things. History acts as awesome outside verification for the Bible. That which is predicted is that which happens. And on a higher level, it shows me that the hand that wrote this book is not only the hand that controls Jewish history, but the hand that controls all of human history. Guys, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Guys, we're a little behind schedule, so if you can please cut the break down to like 5 minutes. Make the food.